I pestered him about the last thing I remembered, asking who the one who catches might be. And he said that the one who catches had seen me and would come again, possibly. In the meantime, I could shut up and have some more blood soup. This took place in a cave, which was a fairly comfortable spot, as caves go, with all the gear of a mountain man, buffalo robes, rawhide and wood furniture, and a good fire going. As I mended, Joe Bright Deer let me go as far as the cave mouth for exercise, and I could see we were in hill country, with a good deal of conifer forest, somewhere in the Bighorn Mountains, I guessed. Outside the cave he wouldn't let me go, and since I was still fairly weak, I didn't argue. Something told me I would find out all I wanted to know if I sat tight long enough. In the meantime, Joe was ready to talk about one subject, in which I was tolerably interested, and that was the massacre I'd survived. Yes, Custer was dead, and every man who'd been on that slope with him. It seems that he'd gone up the Rosebud, but instead of skirting the Indian camp to the south, as Terry had instructed, had decided to take a slap at it himself, and to blazes with waiting for Gibbon. He'd split his force, sending Reno to charge into the camp with about 120 men from the south, while Custer himself took five troops round the flank to fall on the other end of the village. Well, I knew what had come of that, none better. In the meantime, Reno had managed to withdraw and hold out on a bluff until Terry and Gibbon arrived a day later. The Sioux, meanwhile, had decamped. Everyone has had their say on this famous fiasco, and if you want mine, it's this. Custer was going to win an astonishing victory and refurbish his fame. Very well. But having sent in Reno, a piece of arrant folly, unless he was totally ignorant of the Indian strength, he then compounded his lunacy by launching his own attack even after he knew full well what that strength was. I saw that village from the bluffs just as he did, and I'd not have attacked it with anything short of two regiments. It was just too damn big, and patently contained several thousand of the orneriest Indians in America. There are those who say Reno should have pushed harder, and others who say Custer could have charged through and met up with Reno. All me eye. He had one chance, and that was to hightail it the minute he got a good look at the village. But by then he put Reno in the stew and had to go ahead. Mind you, George was such a fool of an optimist, and so obsessed with victory, that I dare say even at the ford he was still believing he had a chance. But the moment he was out on the slope he was done for, and he must have known it. I'll say two other things. If the 7th had had decent carbines, they might have sickened the Sioux and been able to hole up on the hill, as Reno did. And that was Custer's fault, too. He should have tested those pieces before he went near the powder country, tested them until they were red hot, and he'd have seen them jam. T'other thing, Reno deserved the clean bill he got from the court-martial. I didn't know him much, but Napoleon himself couldn't have done any better. If Custer had done half as well, there'd be a few old troopers still telling stretchers about how they survived the struggle up Greasy Grass Hill. Well, I've told you what I know about Custer, and you may judge for yourself. He wasn't a bad soldier, though. Most commanders make a few mistakes, and no one hears about them. He made three in turn, sending in Reno, going in himself, and coming out the wrong way too late. As a result, he lost a pretty bloody skirmish. It wasn't a battle, really. But it shocked America, and he'll never live it down. For his troopers, well, if any of them ran, they didn't catch up with me. For the Sioux, it was their great day, for all it took thousands of them to knock over a few score. Gaul gave them a victory, and Crazy Horse made sicker, as my wife would say. But that's by the way. A historic catastrophe it may have been, but to me it was the penultimate link in my American story, which was now drawing to a close 26 years after John Charity Spring had brought me over the Middle Passage. You may think it was the strangest of all my stories, but you know, as I come to its final pages, it seems perfectly logical, inevitable almost. I might have known how it would be. I'd enjoyed Joe's hospitality for the best part of a month and was nearly whole again and feeling restless. And one evening, as we were having a pipe At the fire, suddenly, there was an Indian in a cave mouth. I hadn't heard him come, but there he was, a splendid figure in black fringed leggings, with paint on his chest, but none on his face, eagle feathers in his braids, and a pistol on his hip. He watched us in silence for a minute, and nodded to Joe. I'd seen him before, I knew, but it took me a moment to place him.
"One who catches," says Joe.
"No, he isn't either," I exclaim. "I know you. You're young Frank Standing Bear. I met you in Chicago with Spotted Tail, and then you and young man afraid rode herd on us at Camp Robinson." I regarded him in amazement. "Is Spotted Tail here?" He shook his head. "The chief sits with his people at White River."
"But he sent you to me?"
He said nothing, and I stared from him to Joe in bewilderment.
"But what's all this nonsense about one who catches? If you're him, then I've been hearing about you ever since I was kidnapped by Jacket and taken to the lodges of the Sioux. What do you want with me?"
Another thought struck me.
"And where's the man who brought me away from the Custer fight?"
He still said nothing. And then, with one of those slow, graceful hand motions, he signaled Joe to leave the cave. He gestured me to sit and sank down cross-legged opposite me, his hands on his knees. There wasn't a flicker of expression on the hawk face as the dark eyes studied me carefully. He seemed to be absorbing every hair of me very thoughtfully, and I didn't care for it a bit. Finally he says,
"I am Standing Bear, the grown man name given me by the Honk Papa Sioux. But as a child among the Brulés, I was called the one who catches, the clutcher, the grabber, because I was greedy and took what I wished."
He said it without amusement.
"The name Frank was given me by my parents. Broken Moon goes alone, and his wife, the black white woman, Walking Willow."
The sonorous drone of the Siouan words, the liquid movements of his hands as he followed the names in sign language, lulled the meaning away from me for a moment. Then it struck home, and my hand began to tremble on my knee, even before he said the next words, his dark eyes intent on me.
"You knew my mother many years ago as Cleonie, a slave girl. You know her now as Mrs. Candy."
"I don't believe you."
It was wrenched out of me.
"Your tongue is forked. You're a Brulé, a full blood Sioux, if ever I saw one. You can't tell me you're her child. I don't believe it."
"You sold her among the Navajo. How should I know that if not from her? And why should she tell it to anyone but her own son, so that he might one day avenge her on the man who traded her for $2,000.
It was as flat and emotionless as Mrs. Candy herself. His fingers flicked like pistons as he spelled out the sum.
"When I was a child, she told me how in the year of the great Cheyenne sickness, she had been in a wagon train of black slave women commanded by a man, Komba, who betrayed and sold her to the Navajo at Santa Fe. Last year in Chicago, when Sinte Kaleska's Spotted Tail took us to the house of Makes Plays and Songs, he spoke to you of the days when you were young men, and how you had led a caravan of black slave girls, also in the year of the great Cheyenne sickness. Then I knew that you, the Washechuska soldier chief, were also Komba."
"Those black girls we watched tonight, yes, they were as pretty as the black ones in your wagons, Windbreaker. You remember them, the year the cut arms were sick. Hona, what little beauties those were."
I could see Spotted Tail's grinning face in the cab as we came back from the theatre, and all I'd been thankful for was that Elspeth didn't understand a word of it. This one had understood, though, and had kept the same stone face he was keeping now. But he'd passed the word to his mother in her Denver whorehouse that Komba was back. And she'd done the rest. My My mind whirled as I took it in. A chance in a million that Standing Bear had been present at Chicago to hear Spotted Tail's randy recollections of 25 years before. But the rest of it fitted like an old shoe. I found myself staring at him. Could he be the child of a Sioux and an Octoroon? Yes, Cleone herself had hardly been black to speak of. Damn it, in her Mrs. Candy guise, I thought she was Italian. And she'd married this broken bollocks fella around 53, by her own account. Well, Standing Bear was certainly somewhere in his early to middle 20s. Oh, Christ, and he'd been treasuring up vengeance against me all these years, and now he had me.
Now, look here, Standing Bear, says I. I believe you, your tongue is straight, but your mother is quite mistaken, you know, as I could have explained to her if she'd only let me. Good God above, I didn't sell her. I loved her truly and dearly and was all set to take her to Mexico, but this wicked old woman who owned her, she sold your mother behind my back.
I shook my fist and went red in the face. That spiteful old buffalo cow could have murdered her.
To sell that dear, lovely girl whom I worshipped and hoped to marry.
Did the priest of Santa Fe speak with a forked tongue?
Asks he quietly. Why should he?
All priests speak with forked tongues, says I earnestly. Every damn one of them. The snake that rattles speaks straighter.
And the wicked old woman? The dark eyes were cold as ice. When I was a little boy, my mother left the lodges of the Sioux and went back to Santa Fe and saw the wicked old woman, Mrs. Susie. The wicked old woman was kind to her and helped her.
He leaned forward a little, and the words dropped like tombstones.
The wicked old woman told my mother how you had betrayed many women and had stolen money and done murder and had a bad heart.
His head shook slowly.
Your tongue is forked. You know it. I know it. You sold my mother to the Navajo.
Well, that disposed of that. Worth a try, though. In the same steady voice he went on.
When my mother learned from me last year that you had returned again from the land of the grandmother, she sought you out and trapped you, as one does the coyote, and had you taken on the Yellowstone by Jacket, brother of Broken Moon Goes Alone, and he brought you prisoner to the Sioux lodges for delivery to me, so that you might die by Kakashia, as my mother willed. I was away on the Rosebud, having fought the Grey Fox Crook, and I came back to Little Bighorn even as Yellow Hair's soldiers attacked. How you came to be in that battle, I do not know, but I saw you there, and I saved you. I threw dust in the eyes of my brothers.
He reached forward to point at my head. I even took your scalp, a little, to deceive them, so that in their fighting madness they should not kill you quickly, so that I should have you. In the face of that awful, implacable regard, the voice without emotion, I could say nothing. I could think plenty, though, and it was all dreadful. I'd been preserved from that carnage, so that I should suffer the unspeakably worse fate designed by that malignant slut, Cleone Candy, a fate that this remorseless savage would take delight in inflicting. Better if I'd died with Custer, or blown my brains out. But wait, there was something here that made no sense.
But you, the man who rescued me, he spoke English like an American.
And how the devil else should I speak it? I didn't have the advantage of a rugby education, you know. Harvard had to be good enough for me. I can't begin to describe the effect of hearing that pleasant, half-amused, half-impatient American voice issuing from the copper-red hawk face with its feathered braids. It was like having a Chinese mandarin suddenly bursting into boiled beef and carrots. I literally couldn't believe my ears. From the sonorous rolling tones of the Sioux, he'd slipped straight into the clipped voice of a well-educated, civilized man, without a muscle altering in his face. It was still a Brule Sioux sat regarding me stonily, until suddenly he burst out laughing with his head thrown back, and then came abruptly to his feet like a great cat uncoiling itself, and stood grinning fiercely down at me, his hands on his hips. No Indian in creation ever stood like that. But he wasn't an Indian any longer. Oh, it was still an Indian's face and body, but the voice, the expression, the gestures, the whole style of him, was of a white man. "That's right, stare all you want to," cries he. "Have a good look. By God, it would serve you right if I went through with it. If I carried out her wishes to the last burning inch, it would have served you right if I'd let them cut you up with Custer. I nearly did." He stood nodding grimly down at me. The grin had narrowed to a tight-lipped smile. "I nearly did, but it wouldn't have done, would it?" I'm not often at a loss for words, but now I sat dumb, understanding nothing, while my heart began to thump like a trip hammer. I felt weak, and though I opened my mouth once or twice, no words came out. I could only stare at the tall, painted savage with his braids and buckskins, the burned thigh brave with his hawk face and red skin. Then I managed to ask, "Why didn't you?" He moved slowly to stand in front of me. "You know why," says he. "You must know why." Suddenly he sank down swiftly in a crouch before me so that his face was on a level with mine, no more than a foot away. He was grinning again, but there was an odd look in the dark eyes, mockery and wariness, and something I couldn't read. "You didn't know my mother when she went to you as Mrs. Candy. Why should you, after 25 years? But this is different. Look at my face, as I've looked at yours. As I looked at it in Chicago and at Camp Robinson and here tonight, even if I hadn't my mother's word for it, just looking would be enough for me. But I have her word, too. But I was born in a Navajo village of New Mexico in spring of the year 1850. It was as though I was hypnotized. It was nonsense, of course, but I looked away and began to tremble again. For I did know the face. I understood why he'd drawn my eye from the first, in Chicago, and again at Camp Robinson, and why I'd felt that strange comfort when he'd ranged up beside me on that hair-trigger day of the council with the agency Sioux. Oh, yes, I knew the face. I'd seen it most days of my life. The bold, dark eyes with the slightly hooded lids, the aquiline nose when he turned in profile. I know my own side view better than most, you see, because of the weeks I spent comparing it with Carl Gustav's picture in the triple mirror at Schoenhausen. Even the full mouth and the heavy jaw. He was a damn good-looking young devil, though, wasn't he, this standing bear? But I couldn't take it in. I'd been too numb by this sort of shock lately. Mrs. Candy was Cleonie. This was her son. And now I was being expected to believe. "Oh, come along, you silly old bastard," cries he impatiently. And I knew it was true beyond a doubt. It would have taken a son of mine at a moment like this to talk to his father that way. But no, it couldn't be true, although I knew it was. I searched for contradiction. You said this Sioux fellow, what's his name? You said he was your father." "That was Standing Bear who said that," says he in Suan. "Standing Bear the Brule, the one who catches, to whom Broken Moon goes alone, was as a father." He broke into English again. "But I'm also Frank Guard, or properly speaking, Frank Flashman, son of Cleonie the slave girl, and the Englishman who sold her at Santa Fe."
"What?"
says I, for no particular reason.
"Guard. French. It was her father's name, so she gave it to me."
He was watching me intently with amusement, and that other glint that I couldn't pin down.
"Comes as a surprise, does it? From all I've heard about you, from Susie Willing, too, I don't see why it should. You must have more bastards than Solomon.
I don't shock easy, but that was like a blow in the face coming from him. And there's no miracle about it, you know. You and Mother... It shocked me, too, to hear him call her that, in that fashion, like a civilized son. You were lovers in the summer and autumn of 49, and while I can't prove my birthday, she's sure of it. The Navajo don't keep parish records either, but there are respectable citizens of Santa Fe, including one notary public, who'll testify that when she arrived there in 55, I had the appearance of a well-grown five-year-old. Well, says he, and grinned triumphantly, how do you do? Papa... It's not easy, you know. He was right enough. I dare say I have buy blows all over the shop. India, mostly. And there's a Count Pentrajevsky in Russia whose paternity don't bear close scrutiny. And one of them was sure to come home to roost in the end. It takes the wind out of your sails, though, when he turns up as a Sioux brave with a Boston accent. For I was in no doubt now, you see. Somehow it was less of a shock than Mrs. Candy had given me, or the news that he was her son. It was almost as though I'd been expecting it. You may say he could have been the child of one of Susie's customers at Santa Fe, but I knew he wasn't. It was not a question of Clay and his word, or his, or even the physical resemblance, which, in an instant, I'd recognized far more easily than Mrs. Candy's to Clay and it. I simply knew. It was there, in him, his being and bearing and manner and style. When he was being white, that is. He was still squatting on his heels before me, watching me with that odd calculating grin, waiting. I don't know what I felt at all, but I know what I did. Well, says I, and put out my right hand warily. How do you do, son? I don't know what he made of it either. He took my hand, firm enough for a moment. But the shine in his eyes could have been anything. Surprise, pleasure, emotion, amusement, anger, hatred even. But my guess is it was pure devilment. The young bastard, and I use the term with feeling, had had me on toast sitting there solemnly playing his noble savage, keeping the old man agog, enjoying watching me squirm while he scared the hell out of me, turning the knife of fear and bewilderment in my innards, and keeping the really juicy surprise to the end. Oh, he'd had the time of his life. Good actor, too. Aye, it all fitted, the skill in histrionics and dissimulation, the delight in twisting the victim's tail, the mockery, the cool, damn you cut of his jib, the callous way he talked of things other youngsters would have been ashamed of. Oh, he was Flashy's boy, no error. Even if I hadn't sold his mama down the river, there'd have been no touching reunion between father and son. We ain't cut out for affection much, our lot. But that's not to say we aren't curious, and now that our formal introduction had taken place, so to speak, we compared notes, mostly his. He was itching to tell it, of course, knowing it must make my flesh creep, which was just nuts to him, being a Flashman. And the shock of that realization still sinking in was enough to render me silent and attentive. If the 7th Cavalry had attacked our cave, I doubt if I'd have noticed. It was a remarkable tale, although not unique. Scores of folk in the Old West grew up half-civilized, half-Indian, as he'd done. So far back as he could remember, he'd been Sioux of the Sioux till he was 5. And when Clanny had gone back to whoring in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, Susie Willink had looked after him, which was a queer start, if you like. But he'd pined for the old life, and had been such a handful that they'd let him go back to Broken Moon Goes Alone, who had died when Frank was about 10. Then, Clanny had put him to school, properly, at El Paso, and sent him east when he was 13. For by then, she was well in the chips at Denver and could afford him the best education going. He'd done on common well and had gone on to Harvard, where he'd improved a talent for languages, which didn't surprise me. And then, to Clanny's fury, had simply upped and gone back to the tribe for 3 solid years. All this, in the most matter-of-fact, off-hand style, leaning against the table, arms folded on his painted chest, one foot elegantly over the other, a stance I recognized only too well. He'd known whose son he was from infancy, and how his mother earned her keep, too.
It was plainly all one to him.
He seemed to have strangely little feeling for her, although he had gathered that it was only by a miracle that she'd kept him alive when he was born among the Navajo. And had done damn well by him since, it struck me.
And you've been with the Sioux? You, an educated man, for the past 3 years?
I asked incredulously. I was still trying to hold them together in my mind, the Lakota warrior who'd ridden to Little Bighorn, and the young student who must have dined at the Oyster House and probably taken tea at Louisburg Square. Not altogether, says he carelessly. I tired of it, I think. It was more home than anywhere, but I'm two people, you see.
Echoing the thought in my own mind.
Anyway, I came in to the agency early last year. It was curiosity, mostly, I guess. That was only a few months before we met in Chicago. Being a Brule, I drifted to Spotted Tail. I'm a full-blooded Sioux to him, by the way. He doesn't even know I speak English. I found it best to keep my two selves separate. Mother and you were the only ones who ever seen both of me. But Spotted Tail found me useful, and it was a lark going with him to Washington.
He grinned at me.
Wasn't it just? Here, though, my stepmother's a beauty, ain't she?
Well, not my stepmother, I suppose, but whatever she is, she and Spotted Tail got on pretty well, I thought.
I didn't ponder on that, but asked why, if he'd come into an agency. He now appeared to be living among the hostiles.
He smiled like a cat that's been in the birdcage.
Oh, that! Being on the agency was a bore, so after your commission made such a hash of the Camp Robinson Treaty, I slipped across to Fort Fetterman as Frank Guard and hired myself to Cook as a scout. Been with him on and off ever since. I scouted for him on the Rosebud last month, you know. Damnedest mess you ever saw.
He laughed. And it was positively eerie to see that cruel, handsome face between the Indian braids crease into the knowing chuckle of a white man.
But the advantage is I can slide out to the other side whenever I choose. It was because I was with Cook that I wasn't at Little Bighorn to receive you with due ceremony. As soon as I could get away from him on the pretext of a long scout, I changed into Standing Bear again and arrived in time for the fun of greasy grass. Lucky for you, wasn't it?
Now, no one in his right mind would have believed this fantastic history, unless, of course, he had himself been a German prince and a Pathan badmash and a Dahomey slaver and an Apache brave and a Madagascar sergeant general, among other things, during his checkered career.
So I believed him, and so can you, and for once you don't have to take my word for it, since much of what I've told you here about Frank Flashman, alias Gua, alias Standing Bear, alias One Who Catches, alias The Grabber, is already public knowledge.
I've a notion that Cook's people are getting wary of me, though, he went on coolly. Not the Sioux, they know I scout for the army and think it a great jest. I suppose that shows which side I'm on, doesn't it?
That was the question which brought us back to the vital matter which had been uppermost in my mind while I listened to his remarkable recital. As he lounged forward and tossed some chips on the fire, I asked, "If that's the case, then what now?"
He squatted easily, blowing on the embers, and glanced up at me with his insolent smile.
"Well, I'm not going to do you in, Papa, if that's what you mean."
Well, I'm pleased to hear it, but I thought that was the object of all this.
"Mother's notion, not mine," says he. "When I told her in Denver last year that I'd seen you in Chicago, she..."
He paused.
"I wondered if she'd gone a little mad. I'd always known that was one of her fondest dreams, that someday I'd be the one to pay you out for what you'd done to her. Sometimes I used to think it was the only use she had for me. Anyway, when I went to see her, she was like a crazy woman. She was always hard, cruel, even. But I've never seen so much hate and spite in anyone, and I've lived half my life among the Sioux."
He looked up at me curiously.
"What was she like when you first knew her?"
"Beautiful. Angelic, almost, to look at.
Oh, but charming, bewitching, clever, quite calculating. Immensely vain."
He nodded cheerfully.
"You're a yard-wide son of a bitch, aren't you, Papa? Did you love her? At all?"
"No. I liked her, though."
but you like $2,000 better.
Well, says this dutiful child, I don't know that I liked her even that much. Certainly not enough, when I was little, to hate you the way she wanted me to.
Why should I? You'd done nothing to me. Hell, I didn't even know you.
And Susie Willink liked you.
Good God.
Oh, sure, Susie used to laugh about you and make you sound a jolly person.
Proper young scamp your old man was, she used to say, and tell me I was another, a chip off the old block.
He laughed, shaking his head.
I really liked Susie.
So did I.
How is she, do you know?
She died 4 years back. She'd gotten married.
He stood up from the fire with his tongue in his cheek.
Again.
Well, I'm sorry that she's dead, I mean.
I was, too. I thought of that handsome, happy face, the wanton lip and gaudy dresses, and... Well, dear old Susie.
Anyway, when I saw Mother in Denver, it never even crossed her mind that I might not share her feelings about you. Later, when she'd laid her plans and sent word, and $2,000, you'll be interested to know, to Jacket and his people, she also sent word to me. I was to be the instrument of vengeance, if you please, and reveal my identity in your last painful moments.
He shook his head in cynical wonder. Honor bright, that's what she wanted. She's a quail, all right. Very passionate and dramatic and a shade meaner than a sick grizzly.
He shrugged.
Well, then I knew she was crazy and I wanted none of it. One reason I joined up with Crook was to be out of the way. Not that I bore you any goodwill, he added pleasantly. And I won't say I'd have shed many tears if I'd arrived on greasy grass an hour later. But, as it is...
I was beginning to like this lad.
What did your mother say? I wondered.
Well, she won't know. She'll think you died in the fight. Not quite as fancy as she'd have liked, but I guess she'll be satisfied.
How come you got into the battle anyway? Didn't Jacket have you hogtied?
I told him about Walking Blanket Woman, and he raised an eyebrow and looked at me for the first time with what might have been some respect, but probably wasn't.
Yes, decidedly he had style, and watching him in the firelight, it sent a tremor through me yet again to think that this splendid brave, with his paint and feathers so at odds with his neo-admirari airs and crooked smile, was who he was.
You got me out, though, says I.
Why?
Frank?
He considered me with what I can describe only as impudent gravity.
Well, it seemed a sensible thing to do on the spur of the moment. I had joined in, like a good little Sioux, hunting long knives. And suddenly there you were. Now that was a miracle, if you like, spotting you and all that. It was when we closed on the ridge and that sergeant broke out and you rode down the hill, so I followed on. You can ride some, though, can't you? I thought you were going to win clear, but I kept up. And when you went down...
He shrugged, and seeing me intent on him, grinned in pure mockery.
Well, now, what would you have done if it had been your own dear papa?
I would get no change out of this one, so I must just play him at his own game. My own game. It took me a moment, so as not to choke or waver, but I managed it.
Well, now, says I, looking doubtful, that's another matter, you see. You didn't know my governor, your grandfather. You might have thought twice about him, you know.
I nodded amiably like the proud father I was.
Anyway, thank ye, my boy. Filial duty, papa, says he. I wonder if Joe Bright Deer has anything for supper.
It isn't every day you find a son, and if you ask me what I thought about it, I can't rightly tell you. It was just damned odd, that's all. I found myself stunned and disbelieving and convinced beyond doubt all in a few moments. And after that, well, there he was. A walking contradiction, to be sure, but real, for all that. I'd been shocked, almost repelled by him once or twice. I'd liked him once or twice and admired him. But mostly I'd just wonders at him. It was so strange to meet and talk to me. If you follow, he acted like me, he thought like me, and take the paint and braids off him, and by God, he looked like me. Even the red skin was just weather, and I'd been darker myself out east.
If there was a difference, it was that I suspected, after greasy grass, he was brave, poor lad. I think he probably was. Got that from Claire on his side, no doubt. As to his deep nature, though, I can't tell. I doubt if he was as big a blackguard as I am. But then he was only half my age, and being so like me, he undoubtedly had the gift of concealing his character. We set out from the cave 2 days later, the two of us. As Frank put it, having come this far, he might as well see me to one of the Black Hills settlements, whence I could travel east. From the cave in the Bighorn foothills, it was close on a week's ride. Crook was chasing hostile somewhere, and Frank figured they'd be rounded up before winter, unless they made for the British border, which seemed likely. The Custer fiasco had evidently scared the Indians more than the army, for they knew what the harvest would be, and the whisper was that only Crazy Horse was likely to fight it out. In the meantime, we went warily, Frank in his paint, and me in buckskin, so that we'd be ready for either side. It was a strange trip, that, across the high plains. It has a sense of dreaming, as I look back on it. Considering our histories, our somewhat irregular kinship, how we'd met, and the initial difficulties of getting acquainted, which we'd managed pretty well, I thought, in our fashion, it was astonishing how easy we dealt. We were still taking stock the first day or so at the cave. I'd catch him glancing sidelong as though to say, "This big file with the whiskers, that's the governor, God help us." And I'd think, "Well, I'll be damned, that's young Flashy." I probably found it odder than he did, since he'd known about my existence, at least for more than 20 years. Yet sometimes it seemed as though we'd known each other all that time, and when we rode out, it was a growing wonder and delight to see him, such a tall brave, so sure and easy, straight as a lance, and rode like a Cossack. I didn't look better myself at his age. By George, I didn't. We talked all the time, from sun up till the fire burned low and the white wolves howled, and the days flew past. I can't think of all we said, but I know one of his first questions was whether he had any stepbrothers or sisters, and I told him about my son Harry, the curate, now a bishop, and a praying one at that, heaven help the church, and my daughter Jo, who was then 18, and my alternate joy and despair, joy because she was as beautiful as a flashy Elspeth child could be, and despair for the same reason, young men being what they are. And one of my first questions was about his alter ego, Frank Gruard, and what did he purport to be, to Crook and other white folk. "Well, back east I was French-American," says he, "but there were some Boston mamas who didn't care for that. So nowadays when I cut my hair and put on a coat, I'm a Kanaka, son of a white father and Polynesian mother, born in the South Seas and brought to the States by Mormons, which is very respectable, and no one knows what a Kanaka is anyway." "Well, never swallow that," says I, "and the Boston mamas won't fancy Polynesian a bit, you know." "They'll swallow it easier than if I tell them I'm half English soldier, half Haitian French freed slave," says he smartly. "As to Boston, it's what the daughters fancy that matters, not the mamas." I warmed to the lad more and more. He, in turn, betrayed a flattering interest in me. Once he discovered that Flashy was the Saxon in the woodpile, he'd read up about me what little he could, and now asked many questions. I dare say he learned more about me in a week than anyone else has in a lifetime. I recall he was curious to know how I'd come by the nom de guerre of Beecham Millward Comer, so I told him most of it. But I remember far better what he told me about his childhood among the Sioux, about Broken Moon Goes Alone, who seemed a decent, dull sort, about his days at Harvard, about what it had been like to be an Indian among white boys and men, and a white man among Indians, of which I knew something myself, about books he'd read and music he liked and plays he'd seen, all that kind of thing. But always he returned to the West and talked of the tribes and hunters and the hills and the great plains. And I noted a strange thing. We spoke English all the time in the same bantering, half-serious way that comes natural to me, and obviously came as easily to him, with wry comments and understatements. But when he talked about the West, it was in pretty plain English, with a phrase of Sioux here and there, and sometimes lapsing into the language altogether. I knew there was something there I couldn't touch, goes beyond blood, to country and the place where you were little. And when he talked of them, there was something growing in my mind, but I didn't like to speak of it, for fear. Until the last evening, when we'd ridden south and east all day towards the dark outline which is the Black Hills of Dakota, the slopes of dark conifer which were so still and mysterious in those days. We rode into a long reach of prairie with tongues of woodland on either side, in the summer gloaming, and Frank was whistling Gary Owen, which might be odd in a Brule warrior, but not in the American son of an English soldier. I was just casting about for a snug corner to camp, when he reins up and says, "Well, you know, I think I should turn around here." "What's that? Why, we're just going to camp, and what about Deadwood tomorrow?" "Good Lord, you can't just pop off now. It's far too late for one thing, or we've had no supper." "Well, I shan't be coming into Deadwood anyway," says he. "I doubt if they're welcoming Sue just now." "Nonsense. Put your braids under your hat if you like, or better still, cut them off, and who'll know the difference? A suit of buckskins." "No. I'd best be going now." "But damn it all, we haven't had any time to... well, to say goodbye and so forth. And there are things I want to ask you, Frank, you know, rather important things."
"I know," says he. "Better not, really."
"You don't know what they are yet. Now, see here, let's light a fire and have some grub and a smoke and talk things over."
And I stopped, because in the dusk I could see he was shaking his head with the two eagle feathers, and when I reined closer I saw that half smile with the look that I hadn't been able to fathom that first night in the cave. "We'd better say goodbye now, Papa," says he. I took hold of his rein.
"Now hold on, Frank," says I, and ordered my thoughts. "It's like this. I don't think we should say goodbye at all. Do you know what I mean? I think... look, I want you to come back with me." There, it was out now. "Back east, and then perhaps back to England. Well, here's the way of it. There are things I can do for you, Frank. Things that no one out here can do, if you understand me. Now, for example, if you wanted, I could get you into the army. The British Army, or the American, if you'd rather. I know people, you see, like the President and the Queen, you know? Well, you could make a simply splendid career as a soldier."
"Fighting the Sioux for Uncle Sam?" says he lightly. "Or a half-caste officer in one of your exclusive cavalry regiments?"
"Half-caste be damned. You look no more like a half-caste than I do, and even if you did, it makes no odds. But it wouldn't have to be the army if you didn't care for it. Why, you could go to Oxford, or back to Harvard, perhaps, work at the language, go into the diplomatic, or anything you fancy. It'd be nuts to a chap like you.